My name is Michael McCusker. Today is April 29th. I'd like to read something I wrote, actually two things that I wrote within this half hour, so I have to give the disclaimer that this is my opinion and perhaps my opinion in the entire cosmos. And a good gust of wind blew in through the open window, so if you do hear any sounds on this lovely spring day, I do have a studio window open. Old wars never die. We cannot ever again allow ourselves to be misinformed, manipulated, and misled into disastrous foreign adventures. In Vietnam, we finally have reached the end of the tunnel, and there is no light there. And that was Walter Cronkite on CBS Evening News, April 29th, today, 1975. The Vietnam War, which the United States lost after a decade of intense escalation, ended 30 years ago, tomorrow, on April 30th, 1975, 2 centuries and 11 days after the American Revolution began. The emergence of the United States as the most powerful nation in history is generally commemorated each year since 1945 by warfare's most dramatic event, the nuclear holocaust of 2 Japanese cities that ended World War II. But the U.S. was challenged by another rising superpower, Soviet Russia, which had at enormous cost, 24-plus million at latest count, defeated the principal Nazi German army. May 8th is VE Day 65, and absorbed Eastern Europe as the fulcrum of its fatally inflated empire. The upper layer Cold War that resulted precipitated hot wars in relatively obscure Third World regions. The Vietnam War was a sideshow that took over prime time by its duration and futility. The American government was willing to sacrifice a generation to the war. The American public was not, and ultimately prevailed though many thousands died in the interim, and many more millions of lives were shattered or at least irreversibly altered by the war. And that is prologue to what I'm going to read, and I'd like to start with a poem by Brian Alec Floyd, who survived both the war and the United States Marine Corps. Our village. This is what the war ended up being about. We would find a VC village, and if we could not capture it or clear it of Kong, we called for jets. The jets would come in low and terrible, sweeping down and screaming in their first pass over the village. Then they would return, dropping their first bombs that flattened the huts to rubble and debris, to dust and ashes. And then the jets would come back once again in a last pass, this time to napalm, to drop napalm that burned the dust and ashes to just nothing. Then the village, that was not a village anymore, was our village. And it was by Brian Alec Floyd. On the day the war ended, I telephoned a friend who had shared a small part of it with me. He was angry and bitter. The wrong side had won the war, and its victory made a mockery of the deaths of 58,000 Americans, he said. A few of them had been our friends. I argued that millions more Southeast Asians had been killed, and that finally, after a generation of incessant war, the survivors could get on with their histories in relative peace without interference. I did not anticipate the boat people from Vietnam, the wars with China, or the murders of 2/3 of the people of Cambodia by its new leaders. My friend and I have not spoken since that last day in April, 35 years ago. The North Vietnamese Army had just marched into Saigon and renamed it Ho Chi Minh City after Vietnam's George Washington, who died 6 years earlier. For them, 3 decades of bitter civil war were over. They had also fought and defeated 2 Western powers that attempted to dominate them. My friend and I were only briefly involved. We spent not much more than a year in Vietnam, and our friendship did not last beyond it. We thought our experience there would bind us for life, but our separate opinions made us adversaries instead. He supported the war. I was against it. He thought I was a traitor of the worst sort, that I betrayed the men we fought alongside, especially those who died or were crippled from wounds. I thought nobody else should be killed, which meant protesting the war in order to end it. We had been U.S. Marines, adolescent gods of thunder who crawled earth in pursuit of death. We were anachronisms, infantry in the nuclear age, and though we killed with modern weapons, we warred no differently than the ancients who hurled spears. We were parts of a machine, each of us reduced to a specific function in a common mush, hammered and smashed around like a piece of rock until it takes the shape of a weapon. From the beginning, it seemed as if we had done nothing else in our lives but kill and die under a hot sun or in mud and rain. We attacked and smashed small villages with rifles, artillery, and bombs. We fought through sudden, wildly violent ambushes and were constantly plagued by snipers, landmines, and booby traps. We exacted savage revenge for every death or wound. We murdered the vulnerable because we seldom could find or identify the phantoms who shot at us or blew our bodies apart with concealed explosives. In the villages, we beat poor peasants or allowed our Vietnamese allies to torture them. We tied old men and boys, sometimes women and girls, to trees and set our dogs at them. We attached electrical wires to their genitals or nostrils and cranked the switches. We threw them out of helicopters. We were murderous armed children who sympathized with nothing except our chances for survival. We wished for nothing more than to leave Vietnam, although it has never left us. Everything that happened to us there seemed beyond reason or moral speculation. A garish kaleidoscope of terrible sounds and bleeding flesh, bound by distant voices on military radios and by helicopters that flew in food, ammunition, and replacements in exchange for the wounded and dead they removed like disposable rubbish. Artillery rounds and jet bombers shrieked over our heads and annihilated villages, paddies, and jungles and left us alone with torn or burnt bodies of humans and animals strewn in fields or among the ruins of homes. Helicopters carried us like deadly viruses to remote valleys and mountains whose only contact with Western civilization were the bombs and napalm dropped by the jets that preceded us. We hacked through jungles, walked through oceans of wet rice fields, crawled and ran toward burning villages, shooting rifles and machine guns at everyone in them. Everywhere we went, we destroyed almost everything. We had come several thousand miles, several hundred thousands of us, generally ignorant of why we should. Officers with charts and pointers explained that the future of Western civilization demanded our presence in Vietnam. Here we would stop godless communism and reverse the domino theory. We fought because the Vietnamese asked for our help, the officer said, then contradicted themselves by warning that we would surely lose our lives or limbs by trusting a single Vietnamese. Old grandmothers planted mines and booby traps. Children sold soft drinks filled with shards of broken glass and blew themselves up with explosives in crowds of American soldiers. Young women were whores and artfully concealed razor blades in their vaginas. Farmers and their sons and daughters were enemy Viet Cong guerrillas at night. We in the lesser ranks understood the riddle, but most of us did not care. It was implicit that even the lowliest of us represented a superior civilization, and as had the French who were there before us, our attitude toward the Vietnamese was that they were inferior to us. Finally, back home, I was tormented by what I experienced in Vietnam. At some point in the war, I was unable to accept the brutal racism, the fear and loathing of Americans toward Vietnamese. I had never seen a people so determined to survive with so little to recommend it. They fought relentlessly against foreign invaders, and no matter how well we deceived ourselves about the war, the Vietnamese were not deceived. Though I never accepted their cause, I learned to respect the uncompromising manner in which they fought for it. The indiscriminate war we fought against them made their success inevitable. I became involved in the American anti-war movement as an early member of Vietnam Veterans Against the War. I wrote articles, gave speeches, and took part in protest rallies and demonstrations all over the country. I was gassed, maced, clubbed, and arrested, which seemed a form of retribution for my part in Vietnam. I threw my war medals at the Capitol Building in Washington, D.C. in April 1971 with 1,000 other Vietnam veterans, and a week later was one of 20 vets who dumped large amounts of fresh chicken scat on the front steps of the Pentagon. We might have used explosives instead of a substance one of us, when arrested, said was foul defecation distribution. We called ourselves in the patois of the area the Chicken Bleep 20. Our message was that Frankenstein's monster was bringing the war home. I was often called a traitor, as my friend accused me. My feelings were the opposite. I felt I betrayed the ideals of my country when I fought in Vietnam. At home, I was obsessed with unearthing the rot underlying history, the agreed-upon fictions that create cultural and racial myths and sanction conquest and empire. Vietnam removed my trust in government, and I learned to regard patriotism as a narrow and cynical appeal for prejudice, injustice, and murder. We learn from history that we learn nothing from it, George Bernard Shaw et al. Said. Vietnam was a cynical war of attrition designed by men who knew little of history but thought they could impose their will upon it simply because it was their will to do so. The United States replaced the French in Vietnam in exactly the manner that led to their defeat. But our arrogance was that we were Americans and we confidently committed the same errors as if we could reverse them by the force of who we were. We raised Vietnamese culture and slaughtered its people as if it was our historical prerogative. We imposed a hated government and enforced its control with our bombers and battalions. We dropped perhaps as many bombs on Vietnam as during all of World War II and poisoned its fields and population with herbicides sprayed from the sky. We invented the body count as an index and declared every peasant we killed an enemy, which was proved by their deaths. We removed hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese from their ancestral farms and villages to prevent them from assisting the guerrillas we were never able to destroy, and abandoned them to filthy, overcrowded refugee camps or to beg and starve or whore in the cities. We hired death squads to liquidate political opposition and participated in the opium trade to pay mercenaries. At one point, although the killing did not stop, the Vietnam War was officially declared over. The last American soldiers came home. One wrote on a wall at Saigon's Tansanut Airport, "Will the last American to leave please turn out the light at the end of the tunnel?" There never was a light, only a long, dark tunnel into which millions disappeared, among them almost 60,000 dead Americans. Of the 500,000 American wounded, thousands returned home without legs, arms, or genitals. Thousands more were paralyzed physically or psychologically. The wounded overflowed U.S. military hospitals in Asia and Europe. The most critically injured eventually flown to stateside hospitals near their homes if possible, but more likely they would end up in VA hospitals too poorly funded and understaffed to adequately care for them. The dead were also returned and invisibly crossed the country in railroad mail cars or jetliner baggage compartments. Five presidents tried to keep the Vietnam War from upsetting the citizenry. They promised guns and butter while sacrificing the nation's sons and money. Night after night, the public was numbed to the war by the artifice of television news, yet few ever saw any of the American dead. The mention or sight of dead or wounded GIs was considered bad for morale. American deaths were edited out of the war. At the same time, the war's measure of success was a grossly exaggerated body count of enemy dead. After the euphoria of the initial massive buildup of U.S. troops in 1965, after Operation Starlight and the Ia Drang Valley, after Tet 68 and Khe Sanh, after Wei and My Lai, after Nixon sent the army into Cambodia and it returned with heroin, the American public became dismayed with its soldiers, sons, and daughters. Something solid was expected of soldiers, but the Vietnam generation was beginning to change, and into what? The soldiers wore peace medallions into combat, smoked marijuana, also opium and heroin, killed their superiors and sabotaged weapons and equipment, and rebelled against the military by the thousands. No one but the soldiers understood that the rebellion was a desperate yet rational response to the war and the iniquities of the military system and its callous disregard for the lives of its lower ranks. The ratio of approximately 14 non-combatants to one combat man, the racial tensions that threatened to engulf every military installation at home in Europe and Asia, the draft that provided escape for the upper classes but hardly any for the poor or non-white, were some of the factors that heightened dissatisfaction in the ranks. But it was the intensifying doubts about the purpose and morality of the war itself that were the most unsettling. For many soldiers, perhaps most, there was no other fight in the war other than self-preservation, mixed with grim awareness they were being badly used. They were brutal, murderous, and insensitive. They were also terrified, anguished, and spiritually desolate. On April 30, 1975, the Vietnam War finally ended, 10 years after American Marines landed in Da Nang, and 3 years after most U.S. forces had been withdrawn. The United States spent a generation attempting to dominate Southeast Asia, yet the war was lost long before it committed its armies. We knew little and cared less for the cultures and peoples that lived there, and our genocidal hubris ultimately caused our defeat. We failed in our attempt to impose the rules of chess in the land of Go. The loss of the war in Vietnam shocked the people of the United States. It might have been different if the war had been won. The people might not have been so ashamed or divided. Victory is its own therapeutic morality. If the war had been won, the cause would naturally have been considered just. The men who designed the war blamed its loss on the men and women who survived it. We were made its scapegoats and shunned as lepers and losers. Our friends and families were ashamed of us. We had been the nation's agents in a dirty, unpopular, and unsuccessful war and were, as a result, treated as if we were also dirt. We were expected to pick up our lives as if we had not been changed in the pitiless crucible of combat. War pared us to the raw edge of perception, but we were implored to reaccept our culture's illusions and vanities and conform to a perspective of history our experience repudiated. We were pariahs, not entirely because we rankled the public memory. The war left us with irreversible knowledge about ourselves that people usually wish to avoid. We learned that only human beings commit inhuman acts, and that the most cherished and humane values serve as war cries to commit horror. We learned that concepts about the worth of life are worthless as arguments to preserve it. We discovered it is absurdly easy to kill and that it is common to feel relief and satisfaction at the anguish of someone else. We learned how to reduce flesh and blood to abstract contempt to facilitate our reduction of it to dust. The price of survival has been high. Many disorders, which are still evident years afterward, had their origin in the terror directed at us and the terror we repaid it with. The saddest irony is that so many who fought like beasts to live through the war have suicided since returning home. The poisons we sprayed upon the Vietnamese are killing us now, although the government stonewalls the claims of veterans that they are sick or dying from the chemicals. Jails were for a long time filled with Vietnam veterans. We are alcoholics and heavy drug users. We are unpredictably violent. All sorts of syndromes have been attributed to us or invented to describe us. Studies are routinely commissioned to define or find solutions to our social depravity. We formed rap groups to assist each other, but these often serve to intensify our maladjustment or alienation. A number of veterans retreated from civilization and lived isolated in forests and deserts. The nightmares that seldom leave us, even so many years later, exacerbated by more recent wars, retain an incompleteness that reflects our fragmented experience in the war. For most of the decade of massive escalation, hundreds of thousands of us went to war and returned daily almost without notice. We passed each other, going and coming to and from Vietnam. The war never entirely slides out of my thoughts. Sometimes it lies quietly on the far side of my mind like a sleeping dog, but eventually something triggers its loop to the closer circuit, and almost everything I do, see, or think about has its parallels and its substance rooted in Vietnam. I spent only a year in combat, but it shines through the murk of subsequent years with a clarity missing from the rest. To survive, I cut off sensitivities I believe are irrecoverably lost. I continue to feel that every day is extra, and I will never comprehend why or adequately use to justify. I believe I was measurably responsible for the deaths of Vietnamese whose lives were worth more than my own, and that friends who died would have been more useful alive than I am. I remain haunted by the dead. Everyone who has endured combat is drawn ever afterward toward death, grimly aware escape has been only temporary. Dead friends vex survivors with sorrow and guilt and beckon for us to rejoin their company. I was at the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C. when it was dedicated in 1982, looking for names of a few dead friends I last saw wrapped in bloody ponchos and tossed aboard outgoing helicopters. I felt smothered by flags and military bands and thought the ceremony had little to do with reconciliation, but was staged instead to revive a war fever Vietnam had cooled. Yet our presence must have been an intense embarrassment, a tattered and crippled specter of a lost war. I felt disconnected much the same as I might have felt at a school or scout troop reunion. I had forgotten names I thought I would always remember. Names of the dead occupy the black marble wall of the Vietnam Memorial chronologically by the days of their deaths, arranged in daily sequence in alphabetical order, so that they will forever remain together, sculptor Maya Lin said. I ran my fingers in the carved grooves of names I remembered. They had been dead a long time by then, and I felt slightly indifferent. I realized names that should have been on the wall were missing, some of our own, who had not been initially included for petty reasons, such as those who died of wounds later, and no women. But also the names of dead allies and enemies, and especially millions of ordinary people who were shot or bombed because it was their bad luck to be in the way. They continue to die from landmines planted everywhere in Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, from malaria caused by millions of bomb and shell holes that breed mosquitoes, and by the effects of biocides such as Agent Orange. I thought there should be a separate wall with the names of the murdered dead of My Lai and Wei to serve as a warning that the only enemy is the malevolence we humans display toward each other. nearly unnoticed against the Vietnam wall among flowers, war medals, and photographs of dead young soldiers, sailors, pilots, and Marines, was a hand-lettered square of cardboard with the names of four war dead who had not been nor are yet included. They were killed in early May 1970, just after American troops invaded Cambodia, the four students shot down by the Ohio National Guard at Kent State College. I left D.C. with friends from Oregon. We drove through Virginia, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Nebraska, Wyoming, Utah, Idaho, and Oregon, reaching home in Cannon Beach on the North Oregon coast 5 days later. We stopped every night at motels or the homes of friends or relatives, and each day we made several stops for food, gas, and just to get out and stretch. On the back window of our small truck was a Vietnam Veterans of America sticker, the group that built and dedicated the Vietnam War Memorial. Everywhere we stopped, people noticed the sticker, and almost everyone was related to or knew someone killed in Vietnam. Everywhere we stopped, I opened a book I purchased at the memorial. It was the size of a small city's phone directory and contained the names engraved on the wall and where each was located. I looked up names people wished to see, and many touched the letters in the book, as so many have embraced the names on the wall with their fingers. By the time we reached the Pacific coast, the American Book of the Dead, as I called it, was as well thumbed as a phone book in a public booth. Until then, I had not really understood the personal impact of Vietnam on America's heart. Each time I opened the book and looked for a name, I felt I was performing a ritual of immense, unrecognized grief. Perhaps the most enduring lesson of the Vietnam War, and a major reason the government would wish to suppress it from public memory or attention, is that a significant number of Americans were against it. When they were rebuffed by the government, they went out into the streets and risked injury and arrest. Thousands of young men chose exile or jail over service in Vietnam. Other thousands who were in the military rebelled against it. Although a reconstructed myth portrays dissenters as irresponsible students, antisocial hippies, and various other types of misfits and malcontents, the largest number of anti-war activists were from the mainstream, and in the spring of 1971, the mainstream peaked when 500,000 of them, the official body count of U.S. forces in Vietnam at the height of the war's escalation, marched through the streets of Washington, D.C. to demand an end to the war. Seldom mentioned and disparaged when it is, the American people ultimately forced its government to abandon its discredited ambitions in Southeast Asia. It is that which disturbs our leaders most and which they would have us forget, that we can and must, if necessary, curb our government's misuse of power. Underneath the spectacle of pageantry and deceit of patriotism, the disturbing presence of Vietnam veterans demonstrates, with the subtlety of a clenched fist, that war is death and horror. It is murder and depravity, and sickens the souls and minds of its executioners. Vietnam veterans give war a bad name. And that was something I wrote. Old wars never die. And I read it today to commemorate tomorrow's 35th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War. Although, of course, wars have continued and probably always will. At least that one was over for the purposes it was fought. Well, on Saturday is May Day. So I'd like to read something I wrote about that, which I call May Day. And my disclaimer still holds. May Day. A call for rebellion, a call for change, a call for help. May Day, the ancient celebration of spring, the festival of rebirth. May Day is celebrated all over the world in every culture and kitchen. For many, it is Labor Day in honor of the anonymous billions who break their backs or wear out their nerves for their daily bread. It is the symbol of seeding the earth in hope of good harvest to ease the dreadful hunger that stalks the human race. May Day is also a day of revolution, a charge against history that demands sweeping changes among the world's societies. This claim usually originates from compassion and the perception that there is no excuse for anyone to go hungry, be without shelter, or denied adequate health and medical care. It is the demand for freedom and respect of all the world's people. The world situation perpetually eludes optimists and idealists. The future blows a sour breath at the present. Earthquakes, fires, floods, and epidemics ravaged the planet. Peace is not on the earth, but a few feet under it, for millions who die from war, hunger, disease, or abuse. The balance of wealth and distribution of resources is dismally inequitable, which intensifies the disparity between rich and poor. Millions are out of work, their lives ruined by poverty and economic collapse. Millions more die from famine and epidemics. Oppression, tyranny, and corruption infect the world's governments. World leaders move pitilessly against their own peoples and their neighbors. Armies and police kill innocent people in retaliation for terrorist acts, which perpetuates terrorism. Populations are the major targets of wars, contrary to pious perfidy, which makes war itself a foremost and persistent act of enormous terrorism. The terror of world annihilation looms iconically 65 years after the first atomic bombs obliterated two Japanese cities and gave birth to the nuclear age. We have built a global greenhouse and we dwell within. We have pummeled and plundered our home planet as if it offered an inexhaustible feast without charge or cleanup. But the consequences of our careless and excessive indulgence are converging, approximate with our disregard and denial. Our probable proximity to extinction is not from any single cause or danger or combination of them, but because we seem helpless as well as unwilling to undo the damage or change direction. Our paradox is that our opulent civilization is based on processes that threaten to obliterate it. We will most likely strangle on the effluence of our affluence. The millennium is an X-ray of our history which lies behind us like an immense junkyard that seems cluttered with artifacts of no use to us anymore. Very little will remain in the conscious memory of the 20th century in this new millennium. Images of Hitler and the mushroom cloud might continue through the centuries. We try to escape history as if by accelerating past we are Teflon'd. But history brought us to where we are and made us who we are. This new millennium evokes old prophecies, apocalyptic cults that believe the end of history is at hand, flourish and seize theolytical power all over the world. Inexorable bipolar dogmata armed with the means to achieve what ancient prophecy continues to incite. The poets might be right after all. The prospect of peace is more irrational than the dark, brooding desire for murder each of us hosts like a malevolent gene. Humanity's penchant for sinister error, folly, mass psychosis, and loathsome horror gives our sense of humor, our appreciation of the comedy of inescapable death. Yet optimism persists. Perhaps because in even the worst of times, our predecessors always raised a maypole for themselves and their children to dance around. Perhaps in especially the worst times, it is necessary to hope. And that was something I wrote called May Day, which, like almost everything else I write, I continue to revise. Probably will until I'm under the dirt. There was a post, an old French painter who once had his work up in the Louvre, a post-expressionist, that was the expression I was looking for, Rousseau, who had his paintings up in the Louvre. And the guards of the Louvre were always warned to not let him get close to his paintings because he had paintbrushes and paints in his back pocket and was always touching them up. So I think for anybody that writes, paints, makes music, nothing is ever completed until finally there is no breath left in the body to complete anything, and there it stands for the rest of whenever. And on this 29th of April, the day before the Vietnam War ended in 1975, and this has been Michael McCusker.